Welcome to the Minerals and Royalties Podcast, the home of CEOs and investors in the minerals and royalties space.
Hey guys, this is Tim Powell from the Minerals and Royalties Authority. I recently sat down with Kevin Thua, managing partner of Jetrock Analytics, a data analytics and IT company focused on the oil and gas industry. During the episode, Kevin breaks down the data infrastructure and analytical side of the minerals and non-op space, and then finishes the episode talking about AI, ChatGPT, and how they're going to transform the oil and gas space going forward. Let's jump into the episode and hear more of what Kevin had to say.
All right, Kevin, good morning and welcome onto the podcast. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Yeah, good to be here.
So I always like to start with some personal context, and you have a little bit of an interesting past. So I want to spend some time on that before we talk minerals, non-op, AI, technology, you know, what your day-to-day looks like. And so I'm going to set the scene here with two comments. Number one, you're clearly a smart guy, UT, and then spent some time at MIT. So not to talk down on any of my brother in the space, but land guys don't typically have the highest grades in the world, but they're good at doing deals. You are lifting us all up in the mineral space, though. Clearly, you're one of the smarter ones in that we have in the industry. So really curious to hear that background. And then second, you spent some time with NASA. So you're an astronaut or aspiring to be one. So would love the context where you grew up, the years at school, and how the windy road of your careers ended up where it is today.
So I grew up, like, space is sort of my first love. I grew up in Houston, so like Johnson Space Center. I have an uncle, my dad's brother was an astronaut in the 90s. So I got to go 2-3 shuttle launches in Florida where you get to like sit at the family viewing area that's like 2 miles back from the launch site. And there were so many delays in the launch for one of them that I had to get like a special exception to pass second grade or something like that. So you say I'm a smart guy. I guess you could say I almost failed second grade from so many unexcused absences, but I did make it through the end of my education. Yeah, while I was at UT, so mechanical engineering is what my degrees are in. So I like building stuff, tinkering with stuff. Like, that was my first, you know, way of interacting with the world. And I later came to sort of like the data side of things. And when I was at UT, again, my uncle, it's literally the definition of nepotism, of like helping your nephew get something. So he helped me get an internship at NASA. It was actually in their airplane division. So I got to do 3 summers there working on projects on their T-38s, which were like training jets for the astronauts, and some other planes, including the Vomit Comet, which is probably the most well-known version of it. So NASA space, like that's where my career was started.
Well, hold on. Yeah, I want to hear stories about the Vomit Comet. And what exactly is that? I've heard of that, but I don't really know what it is and what it entails. So please, I don't speak to someone from NASA every day. Can you give me some inside stories?
For sure. So I'll tell you what the Vomit Comet does, and I'll tell you why they let me get in on it. So first, like, what the Vomit Comet is, you think about like a jet airliner, like similar to what you get on to fly across the US. They've taken out all the seats and they've padded all the walls so that you can't hurt yourself. And they go out over the Gulf of Mexico. This is to give astronauts experience in weightlessness before actually like going into space. And they fly a parabola. So like they get out over the Gulf of Mexico and they pull way up on the stick. So you're slammed into the ground. I don't know how many feet you go up, but when you come over the top, it's like the biggest roller coaster you've ever been on. So you come over the top and then suddenly you're floating as you're plummeting down to Earth. So I think if I could have seen like the Gulf of Mexico, like the boats and stuff getting bigger and bigger, probably would have taken away some of the fun. But you're enclosed, there's no windows or anything. So you feel like you are weightless for about 30 seconds at a time. And so you do 30, I think it was 30 parabolas. You also get to like experience moon gravity, which was also cool because you're like bouncing. And it was super fun. So I got to go on that one because they're kind of nice to the interns. Like it's sort of like a treat for if you're working out of their aircraft division. But I think it was my second summer, I was working on a project to redesign the toilet that is on the Vomit Comet.
Okay.
So yeah, it's like that's the type of job, of course, they give to the intern. And then the quick story there is that like the existing approach was, it was basically like a bucket with a lid on it was the bathroom. And in zero G, obviously that caught, because a big problem if somebody goes back and uses the bathroom and doesn't tell the flight crew, which apparently would happen often enough that they wanted a different solution. Obviously, in zero G, everything goes everywhere. And so then the flight crew got to clean that up. So my job was they were outfitting a new plane to take over the role, and they wanted to keep the existing like blue water toilet system, you know, you've used on United Airlines or whoever. But you need about 7 different valves and a setup to like lock it down while you're in zero G, and then where you can open it back up. So my little mechanical engineering project was to figure out, okay, well, like if you add a knife edge gate valve underneath this area, and then you need pressure relief over here, like this is what it looked like. So that was what my project was. And then actually being on the bomb, it was super fun. And it's like when you're on a roller coaster and you get that feeling of like you're stomach going up into your chest, that only lasts for like 2 or 3 seconds as you're kind of coming over the top. And then you feel it's more like you're in a swimming pool. But the weird thing is there's no like resistance. Like if you try to like paddle, it's a very different feeling. So people tend to kind of just flail around at first. You have to figure out, you have to like push off of the walls and that sort of thing. So there's a lot of detail there, but it was cool. It was one of the coolest experiences of my life.
Welcome to An Ounce of Prevention. The team at Our Recent Associates has partnered with Tim Powell to bring you brief legal updates on issues that matter to mineral owners, non-ops, and operators. We hope you find this segment informative. As always, if you have any questions, feel free to reach out to me, Rachel Reese, at rreese@rreeselaw.com. Today's update is on the Dormant Mineral Act, an Ohio statute focused on simplifying title by unifying the surface and mineral estates and returning unused mineral interests to the surface estate. Although enacted in 2006, the DMA is coming up more and more in discussions with the increase in production in Ohio. At first glance, the DMA seems like an incredibly powerful statute, allowing surface owners to take the unused mineral interests of another without much effort. And as someone who went to law school in Texas, it just seems wild and perplexing. However, the Ohio legislature and the courts have recognized the potential for the DMA to be abused by surface owners and have created some safeguards. First, if in the last 20 years there has been actual production or pooling of the minerals, there has been a recorded title transaction, the pore space has been used for underground gas storage, or a drilling permit has been filed on the minerals cannot be considered abandoned. Further, some interests are not subject to the DMA, such as coal interests, interests held by the U.S., or the state of Ohio. In order to claim the minerals, the surface owner must 1. Serve notice to each mineral owner at their last known address or by publication, if necessary, of the surface owner's intent to declare the mineral interest abandoned. Then 2. Between 30 to 60 days after the notice is served or published, file an affidavit of abandonment in the relevant county. The DMA allows a mineral owner to challenge the surface owner's claim by simply filing a claim to preserve the mineral interest or an affidavit establishing the use or non-abandonment of the interest. While actual evidence of use would be ideal, it appears that simply responding that you wish to preserve your interest is sufficient. On the flip side, even if there exists evidence of the use of the minerals in the last 20 years, and if the mineral owner was properly provided notice but fails to respond, it appears that the minerals will vest in the surface owner. Courts have been taking a closer look at these issues and have clarified the statute on things such as the notice requirement and what constitutes reasonable diligence in identifying and locating the mineral owners, what does and does not constitute a title transaction, and whether the DMA conflicts with other statutes on the subject. I imagine we will get even more case law on this as long as Ohio continues to be a profitable place to produce hydrocarbons. In conclusion, the DMA can be a scary bill for any mineral owners who have yet to act on their interests. However, it's actually pretty easy for a mineral owner to retain their interests as long as they are paying attention. I want to thank Siam Rahman, a law clerk in our Houston office, for this update. Subscribe to our blog, An Ounce of Prevention, or follow us on LinkedIn for the latest updates.
The information and material in this advertisement is general information about our practice and firm and is for educational and informational purposes only. This information does not offer specific legal advice, and the use of this information does not create an attorney-client relationship with RRNA or any of its attorneys. The information in this advertisement should not be considered legal advice, and persons should not act upon this information without first engaging professional legal counsel.
That is super cool. For everyone listening, it's 2003 to 2005, you do those 3 internships. and then Orbital Sciences Corporation. You do that for 3 years. So at this point, this is what you're going to do, right? This is what you think your career is going to be. Is that?
Yeah. Satellite space, like that first job. Again, like shout out to Uncle Pierre. He made an introduction for me at Orbital Sciences, where he also worked. So my early career was heavily influenced by, it's always, you know, it's who you know is, being smart is good, but also who you know. And that's what the landmen you mentioned, that's what they, like, it's your network that I found over the years too, you know, running JetRock. That's probably more important. Knowing the right people is more important than like doing the best job of something. They're both important, but kind of the smart people kind of tend to overlook like that aspect of it, that, you know, you can build a really good widget, but there's a whole network of people that have to buy into that for it to be a success in business.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I'm a big Tony Robbins advocate. He always says business is two things, marketing and innovation. And without innovation, you know, clients will leave. And without marketing, clients never find you, right? I mean, look at some of the name brands that we grew up with. They're not the best soda or the best snack or the best whatever, but they're the best at marketing. That's why we know them, right? So
yeah, that makes sense.
So okay, so then you go to MIT. Why did you go to MIT? 2009 to 2011.
Yeah, so I was working in Orbital Sciences doing satellite and spacecraft design. So it was really cool stuff. Like it was kind of my job was kind of an adult version of building things with Legos, where it was coming up with the mechanical design of the satellite. So it's like you have 20 different options for tank sizes and volumes, or you can make a new one, but that's going to cost more. And you have these electronics, you fit it all together into like a physical entity. That was kind of my job. That was 2008, 2007, 2008, 2009, where like you'll remember the energy crisis of the 2000s, where like oil peaked at $146 a barrel, and are we running out of oil and all that sort of thing. And that really caught my attention. Like I really got into reading a lot about energy and how, you know, different forms of it, how it powers society, all those sorts of like kind of high level ideas. And I decided like that's really what I wanted to do more in my career. I also wanted to go get an advanced degree. Looking back on it, it's like I don't totally know if I knew why I wanted, like I thought I did, but I woke up one morning and I was like, I want to go get a little further in my education where I can bring some like unique learning back into the business environment. So I applied to a set of schools. I got into MIT. It was in their building energy group and their engineering. It was a combination of like engineering and architecture, actually, the group.
You went to MIT with the energy lens. And then that's from that point forward, it was all energy. Got it.
Yeah, I wanted to make that career change. And I viewed like one way to do that is go to school for something that like puts a flag on the ground that this is what you're doing. And that's, yeah. So got into MIT. My project was actually on using solar energy in buildings. So I spent 2 years in Boston doing that. And that was my time at MIT. It was really cold there. I didn't want to stay in Boston. I wanted to come back. Ultimately, I wanted to come back to Texas.
So then you focus on renewables for a few years with DNV, and then you get to drilling info, which is where it starts to get relevant for this audience, right? On the minerals and the non-op side. So kind of 2011 to 2015, what were your roles? What was your focus? And then you founded JetRock in 2015. So kind of the vision for that and where you've taken it since, but over to you.
Kind of a rapid, when you lay it out like that, from like 2011 to 2015, I remember being at MIT and they had little like seminars on how to start a business, or, you know, like the start, because it's a very startup focused culture. And I looked at those and I remember my mindset was like, man, starting your own business, like how do you even figure out all the pieces that need to go into that? And it seems very risky compared to just going and like getting a good job. And so my mindset wasn't there when I was in grad school. The job that I got, so my wife and I decided we wanted to move back to Texas. And specifically, I had gone to UT and I really wanted to come back to Austin. So I did interview in other places, but at some point we said, let's just try to make Austin work. And we rented an apartment here. And almost 2 months after we got here. So it started to be a little bit of sweating about like, what are we doing here? But then, so I got a position with what's now called DNV GL, which is a big energy consulting company. They do more than just wind and solar, but like my part of the company was doing energy analysis on future wind farms. So that means taking a big, messy data set, cleaning it up, running it through a set of processes. It was mainly in Excel at that point to get to, here's how, here's like the P50, P90 of what we expect this future wind farm to produce, and a bunch of other kind of more detailed analytics underneath that. But it was basically to create this report so that they could get financing from banks. The banks could have some level of confidence of like what kind of energy and revenue these wind farms were going to put out. But I did that for a couple of years. And the reason that, so there wasn't a whole lot of like ability to do creative thinking there. Like it was a very well-established process, which is good, but I was kind of felt like I was kind of suffocating in terms of wanting to, like you talked about the innovation part of it. Like there wasn't much room to innovate. And so I was looking for other roles. I was able to land a job with Drilling Info. So jumping from the renewable side to the oil and gas side. So Drilling Info, now called Enverus, they're based in Austin as well. So this was in 2013, I think. It did give me pause. About like, you know, I've been focused on renewables. Like, are the people I know going to feel like I'm betraying them? But like, I still joke about like sort of going over to the dark side for oil and gas. I'm certainly like the PR is not as good on the oil and gas side. But where I was, like that decision point was one, I wasn't happy with what I was doing in my current role. And I do think I can say like I've been consistent over the years of like, I'm still for renewable, even though I'm working in oil and gas, like I'm still for renewables. Like it's not it doesn't have to be an either or thing. And you know, oil and gas powers the world. So like there's very few people who can say that they're like free of the influence of oil and gas. So I did make the jump to what was then called Drilling Info, join their analytics group. And that was kind of exactly what I was looking for in terms of freedom, where we were like a group of four, including my co-founder, Justin Birmingham, was in that group as well. There were four guys, a combination of analytics and data infrastructure, where we just kind of had access to all of Drilling Info's data sets. And the CEO would, he'd give us all his special projects. Like if he was going to give a talk on something and he had an idea, we would like craft those numbers for him, and building kind of more analytics ready data sets off of the public data, cleaning things up, making them so that the companies that signed up for it could use it more easily. So there, I was there again for 2 years. I guess I hopped around a little bit like that, sort of that early career jumping. But so Justin, my co-founder, he actually, a year into me working at Drilling Info, he left to go be an independent consultant doing data infrastructure. So he's like a database guy. He knows the back end really well. Doesn't even necessarily know the ins and outs of like what's happening in oil and gas companies, but he knows how to get data from like 8 different places into a single table that you can do something with. So he left to go do work for Three Rivers Oil and Gas, which is an Austin-based oil and gas company.
Yes, Riverstone originally.
Yeah, they were the backer, yeah, of Three Rivers. So Justin went to go consult for them. And then a year later, like, we needed to wait a year for like our, like the non-compete stuff. You're not allowed to like pull people away. But I joined him after a year and we started doing data analytics. And it was me, for several years, it was me and Justin. So Justin handled the back end, like I was saying, of tapping into data sources, getting them into a centralized place. And then my job was the analyst of turning it into useful end results, be that like dashboards or automated reporting, or find me, you know, depth severances, like take all the landing zones and all the leases in the units and find which, you know, which, where there's pew clauses that leases, like that deeper depths have been released, that kind of thing. So we started JetRock in 2015. So we've been doing it for 9 years now. And I'll say like Justin pulled me into sort of the more entrepreneur way of thinking, because I went from like MIT, one of the most entrepreneurial places, you know, that you'll find in the world. I was like, nah, I probably just want like a corporate job. To then by like 4 years later, I was starting, you know, my own, leaving a, you know, stable, well-paying job with, I guess we were just having our second kid at the time. So it was that sort of leap of faith, but we did have a paying client right off the bat, which is a, which I'll say, like, if anybody's thinking about like starting a business, I think the hardest thing is to get convincing people to pay you any amount of money, because nobody wants to look dumb to their boss. Like that's, to me, like that's how everybody thinks about things. And if you've never done something before, they're like, the concern is that I'm going to pay you some money and you're going to make me look dumb. So if you can show that somebody else has done this before and I've not made them look dumb, that goes so far in terms of getting your second, third, and fourth client. That social proof of like other people are willing to have successfully done this before matters a huge amount, more than it should, but like it definitely is a big part of the what makes a business live or die in those early stages.
Hey guys, I wanted to take a quick break from the conversation to say thank you to all of our podcast sponsors. Looking to ramp up deal flow for your minerals and non-op ground game? Since 2019, the Texas Mineral Company has closed on over 120 deals, totaling $110 million in value, with deal sizes ranging from $50K upwards of $5 million. Whether you're looking for white space, permit, duck, PDP, AFE, or wellbore-only deals, the Texas Mineral Company has got you covered. For more information on how to source deal flow from the Texas Mineral Company, please email Toby Martinez at toby@thetexasmineralcompany.com. Over the past 20 years, Riverbend Energy Group has been the definitive leader in the non-op and mineral space, where they are actively acquiring minerals in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, the Williston, and the Eagle Ford. Following their $1.8 billion sale of their non-op platform in 2022, they are also back actively acquiring non-op interests in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, and Williston. If you have minerals or non-op working interests in these areas that you would like to sell, then please visit www.riverbendenergygroup.com for more information. Farmers National Company has oil and gas experts located across the country ready to provide you unmatched convenience and service for your land management needs. Whether you're looking for turnkey management of oil and gas interests or simply looking for an advisor to help you sell or lease your minerals, Farmers National Company has you covered. Learn more about Farmers National Company's team of certified mineral managers, landmen, attorneys, and accountants by going to fncenergy.com or reach out directly at energy@farmersnational.com. Does your team ever struggle with employee turnover? What about right-sizing your team to fit your company's needs over time? Do you have the right accounting systems and software in place to maintain control and visibility on all your cost centers? If any of these things are challenges in your business, then Opportune's back office outsourcing could be the right solution. For more information, please visit www.opportune.com.
Yeah, no, 100%. And then, you know, it just takes the pressure off internally, you know, in the dark days where you say, am I doing the right thing? Are we doing the right thing? And then there's validation from that client. And then you can go to the next one. I think the hardest, you know, in your world, kind of a lot of folks, I'm sure, that are friends of y'all's that are building out tech businesses and apps that are profit negative for years and years. And then there's like a tipping point. That's not how my mind works, you know, as an entrepreneur. I think that clearly there's a huge part of that in the sector, but I think that's tough. So starting with something where you have cash flow, you have something that works, and then you micro test and scale, there's definitely something to be said about that. And clearly you're around 9 years later, so it's working.
Yeah, we've made it this long. Yeah, it's always been our approach. We've never raised money. We've never needed to. That, like, we've been cash flow positive and profitable every month that we've been in existence. And like, when we get enough new work and we see kind of the runway of what that's going to look like, we add resources as needed. So like, we fund our growth out of our free cash flow, which is kind of an old school idea, as opposed to, like you said, to raise $10 million and burn. You hope that you're like breaking even by the time you've burned the ninth million. That hasn't been our approach. What that does is it's hard to go from zero to unicorn in any kind of reasonable amount of time. But the positive side, like for my own sanity and for getting things right, like it's easy to waste a bunch of money on an idea. Like you said, micro testing, like everything that we do has been proven by the clients that we work with, because it's very interactive with our clients. We're more like an outsourced analytics group that works with each one of our companies. And so that's, right now we have 13 clients right now. So we're a relatively small group, but we are hand in hand with each one of them.
Expand upon the model then. So you guys haven't built a subscription-based, you know, cloud-based software program. It's not a tool, if you may. You're really almost technical and like database framework consulting outsourced to companies. It just unpack that a little bit.
I think it's kind of unique in the oil and gas industry. Like I don't really know of other people approaching it quite this way, that we do both the database side of things. So like tapping into your data sources, be that Enverus, IHS, or your internal accounting data, like Bolo or Inertia, or like for the minerals companies, like MineralSoft, or your CRM tool, like Sugar or Salesforce, like those sorts of things, getting all that into a single data warehouse, and then automating your company's internal processes, both like, let's say, like tracking tracking revenue by like your different entity that you have set up, or comparing like your check stubs to public data to see like, am I getting paid properly for the different operators that I'm underneath? So yeah, so our approach is, it's more like you would hire a person to do this. You're hiring Jetrock to do it. So on the back end, there's a lot of automation that we've built out to make it easy for us to tap into your different data sources and quickly get it to where like my team can do analytics on them. But then the analytics are pretty customized to what each client wants, because no two companies are doing quite the same thing. And that's where we did, like, respectfully, like, that's where we felt like the offering from Drilling Info 10 years ago was kind of falling short, is that is a can, you know, very canned sort of analytics where you could see like how many permits are being filed by county, but that's more neat than useful. Like it needed to be more custom to what the company was trying to do and incorporating more of their internal data for it to really work well.
If I'm listening to you right now and I'm saying, okay, why would I potentially want to work with you? So where my mind initially went was portfolio management. You're talking about checking revenue statements of public data, looking for discrepancies, anomalies. You know, this is on the mineral management side, essentially, is one thing. So that's kind of maximizing what you have already. But now you're talking about analytics on what to track, and that's, you know, customized around a buying strategy, it sounds like. So the companies, the minerals and nano companies you've worked with in the past, or you've spoken to, what are some of the common oversights that you've seen that they don't think of that they would need, or they're just stuck doing it the way they've always done it?
So and you also asked, like, so why would somebody work with us? Like the main driver would be if you have a number of different data sets. So that might be like your accounting data, your public data that you want to work with. You're trying to contact potential mineral sellers. Like there's several different data sets that they don't really talk to each other. You might have 50 Excel files on your desktop that you're trying to unify in some way, or get some kind of an answer that requires multiple data sets. Usually, like if a company is working with a single data set that can live inside of an Excel file, like they're kind of okay. Like there's better things you could be doing there, but at that size and scale, like you can get away with it. When you're trying to mesh different data sets together, like check stubs, for like comparing that to public data, or if you want to do a mailer campaign. So something we've done a couple of times is identifying across a basin, who are the mineral owners? What are their addresses? What production is happening on those? So like, how would you value those assets right now? And then generate a way of getting in touch with them, like automating all that. Like that's a use case of trying to figure out like, well, who are the sellers like that you would go talk to, and who are the most likely ones, and what's the best way to get in touch with them? So that's a use case.
What are, I guess you have things that people right away, they say, hey, can you do this for us? And then the other things are like, ooh, I didn't know I could do that in the minerals knowledge space, given these are smaller companies. What are some of the things that jump to mind that are common meeting to meeting?
Another use case that I see more coming into play is, so for, especially for minerals and non-ops, is if you're using something like, so MineralSoft is an example I use, where it manages all your check stuff together, but a lot of companies aren't, their market penetration isn't that great. So some people are just getting a bunch of like PDFs from different operators. And really all you can do with that is just kind of open them up one at a time and look at them. So if you have, let's say you own minerals that are underneath like a dozen different operators, and you're getting AFE requests or check stub information, they're all in different formats. So a use case, what we would be able to do is create a data pipeline that hooks up into each one of those and creates a unified data set out of all that, so that you can now look comprehensively at all your interests, be able to compare them, see how they're performing. Whereas right now, like without that, they're really just kind of a bunch of files sitting independently on your computer. So that's where like investing in data infrastructure and analytics can let you level up your game, which matters more as you try to scale up. Like when you're real small, like you can do it yourself, but if you try to keep those same practices as your company gets bigger, the wheels kind of tend to fall off.
And is there a general AUM size, amount of money you're trying to deploy per year threshold that you've seen where investing in this kind of stuff makes sense? I mean, just to give you an analogy in a different part of the sector, you know, when I speak with, you know, all the different service providers you need to raise a third-party fund with third-party capital, the threshold's usually like 50 million of fund size for a lot of that stuff to be justified.
Yeah.
Is some sort of similar thing where investing in data infrastructure in-house makes sense?
Yeah. So I'll give you like the, of course, like I want to work with everybody. Like the not the very helpful answer is like, you know, we can help everyone. But what I've seen, like when people make the leap, is it's not like an individual who's just trying to make it out on their own because they just don't have enough, there's not enough cash flow there. And you asked before, like, we try to help every department in the company speed up what they do and make your accountants' lives easier and your reservoir engineers and your geologists. So when there's all those different disciplines, JetRock can add value kind of into each one. When it's just like a solo person, it's hard to pump enough value into that one person to make like the cost of working with an analytics group like ours worthwhile. So most of our companies are private equity backed. And I don't know their fund, like I'd have to pull together their funding amounts, but I think generally, yeah, it's at least $20, $50 million commitments. A bunch of them have like $300, $500 million commitments. So as you get into that range, I think it seems like people are pretty comfortable making the outlay to have like a solid data system.
Fair to say, if you have different departments within your team with, geology, engineering, land, title, accounting, if you have a minerals management component, just the more silos you have, the more data, the more.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, because you're dealing with more data, you have more people that can benefit from this, and it gets harder to do things across groups. So if we can build that connective tissue between all those different data sets so that it's easy for, the C-suite to see the daily production volumes that are going to the production team and that sort of thing. Without humans needing to export CSVs and painfully like put the report together every Monday, we would automate all that.
Got it. Yeah. I mean, what about if I'm a single basin player focused on the Bakken versus I do Bakken, Permian, Haynesville, and Eagleford? Is there, with extra basins, do you think the need for data infrastructure more, or that's kind of just singular types of data and it doesn't matter how many basins?
I think there it's the volume of data. So like, when does it start to overtop the different tools? And so there's a lot of things that like Excel can't handle. I think it's once you get over like a million rows, Excel doesn't have room for it. And even Excel is not very performant when you get into like if you're trying to like do calculations in Excel with hundreds of thousands of rows, that's not uncommon. People will come and be like, we have this Excel file. It used to work well, but now we made an acquisition and the data is much bigger. And so like this Excel file doesn't work anymore. So we'll translate that into a Python. So Python's a programming language. We'll translate that into a Python process that say runs every night so that the end result of their AFE tracker or like a LOE statement gets generated automatically and it doesn't live inside of Excel. So also we use a lot of Spotfire. So Spotfire is a business intelligence tool. It's widely used in the oil and gas industry. Spotfire can handle multiple basins, but if you add the Permian, if you try to load in like all the production data, like that'd be on the order of like 100 million records in a Spotfire, it can start to kind of chug and lag a little bit. So if you try to get every basin in the country into a single Spotfire project, that is potentially a problem in terms of having enough RAM for it to work well. So yeah, if somebody's working in multiple basins, one, it depends on which data sets you're trying to work with. I think I guess a rule of thumb would be if you get above like 50 million records in a table, you're going to start to have problems in Spotfire. Like you're going to have to start thinking about like, do we need to piece this out or use a different tool than Spotfire?
Let's just spitball here for a little bit. So you keep talking about data sets. I love your thoughts on most common data sets and sources that you see in the minerals and auto space, and maybe some things that folks haven't thought about that we can just kind of get on their radar. But again, now where you could potentially get stuff to connect and speak. And at the end of the day, if you can help deliver speed and efficiency, that's the language of this space, right? So let's have a dialogue around that. So for me, tracking permits, any type of announcements in newspapers, right? Obituaries, things of that nature. Tracking, any type of road development, pad development, frack ponds. There's obviously a department with satellite imagery and tracking.
Yeah, I was going to say that. So yeah, to run through like the meat and potatoes is probably like Enverus or IHS, just if you're trying to track what's going on in the industry. So they're the ones with permits and leases and rigs and daily or monthly production from the Railroad Commission. So that's usually going to be your starting point. There's some other folks like like Novi Labs is kind of an upstart in terms of like challenging those bigger, more expensive companies. So that's on the public data side. You mentioned satellite imagery. So we do tap into those too. We don't collect any data directly. We're the octopus that grabs all the different data sets and then mixes them into something useful. So we have worked with data providers on like satellite imagery, where they're identifying like new pad development ahead of like any permits hitting the railroad commission. If you're trying to go get ahead of, you know, the rush to buy assets or something like that's happening, you can see road development or pad development just from analyzing the satellite data. So we've done that successfully. And then in terms of, like I mentioned, contacting buyers. So county appraisal, like especially in Texas, tax appraisal data is a pretty good listing of who owns what in the wells themselves. So using that to come up with your list, your target list of who you're trying to contact to actually buy the minerals. And also, that's a data set unto itself. And if you wanted to connect that with, well, what volumes are those wells that this owner owns an interest in? Like, what are they currently producing? Where are they on their decline? Like, how do I expect it to decline out in the future? What's the undeveloped inventory on those units? That's pulling together several different data sources to get that answer. Like, you can kind of do that one at a time, like pulling up the plat and looking at going into like the DI app. If you wanted to do that across a couple of counties, across a whole basin, we crunch those sorts of numbers so that you can kind of high grade your target list and reach out to them, whether that's like a letter or like a texting campaign.
Hey guys, I wanted to take a quick break from the conversation to say thank you to all of our podcast sponsors. Your property is your legacy, so you should only leave it in the hands of a land management company who has a legacy of its own. If you own oil and gas interests or act as a fiduciary for those who do, you can find a long-term partner at Farmers National Company, who since 1929 has taken great pride in helping clients maximize the benefits of property ownership by providing turnkey management services and by working alongside them through generational transfers of specialized assets such as oil and gas interests and farmland. To learn more, visit fncenergy.com or reach out directly at energy@farmersnational.com. Since 2019, the Texas Mineral Company has been a leading ground game broker for minerals and non-op deals, closing over 120 transactions across the Permian, SCOOP/STACK, Haynesville, Bakken, Powder River Basin, DJ, and Eagleford. With deal sizes ranging from 50K upwards of 5 million and 1.5 NRAs upwards of 3,500 NRAs, the Texas Mineral Company can be flexible on where and how they can source your deal flow. For more information on how your team can work with the Texas Mineral Company, please email Toby Martinez at toby@thetexasmineralcompany.com. Scaling up your portfolio while minimizing G&A is the name of the game in the minerals and non-op space. Whether you're a brand new fund, an established team who's growing quickly, or a fully developed portfolio in harvest mode, Opportune's back office outsourcing team can help. Stop worrying about all the headaches that come along with day-to-day accounting and back office operations and contact Opportune today. For more information, please visit www.opportune.com. Over the past 20 years, Riverbend Energy Group has been the definitive leader in the non-op and mineral space, where they are actively acquiring minerals in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, the Williston, and the Eagleford. Following their $1.8 billion sale of their non-op platform in 2022, they are also back actively acquiring non-op interests in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, and Williston. If you have minerals or non-op working interests in these areas that you would like to sell, then please visit www.riverbendenergygroup.com for more information.
Hi there, it's Rachel Reese at R. Reese & Associates, your outhouse counsel. You may ask, what's an outhouse counsel? Well, it's a law firm that is focused on the day-to-day legal tasks that normally would be completed by your legal department. Our attorneys in Houston and DFW have spent their careers in both in-house positions and at large law firms and can provide your company with the efficient and responsive service you would expect from your own legal department for things like contracts, transactions, and title opinions at a fraction of the cost of what you're used to paying. So whether your company has no legal department or your legal department is a mighty team of one, we can help. Give us a call at 832-831-2289 or learn more at rreeselaw.com.
Yeah, so I mean, I think there's a lot of incredible tech startups. I try to do my best to keep on top of them here and you know, get them on the podcast to, again, help folks with speed and efficiency, right? I think there's a worry, especially as times get a little tight. It's like, okay, this is 20 grand a year, 50, 80, whatever it is. And then you go, well, what if I don't use it? It sounds good in theory, but now I have this and you have all these different subscriptions. So that's where you come in, is to maybe you sit down with a client's management team and they say, hey, we subscribe to all these things. This is what we think is possible, but this is what we need to execute. And then you help create dashboards and common analytics to help feed the strategies. Is that a good understanding?
Part of how I pitch it is like, we allow you to get value out of your data. Like, you're paying for data, you're collecting data, but in a lot of cases it's just kind of sitting there. Or there's like one person at the company who knows how to access each individual data set, but then they're not able to like talk to each other and integrate. So yeah, our MO is when we're working with a new company, we say like, bring your wish list of, and we learn what their data sets are up front. What would y'all like to be able to do? And then we can speak to, okay, well, we've done these things before. Like, these are things that we've done before. Here's what works and doesn't work, or you need to change how you're collecting this kind of data. But it's also really common for there to be ideas that like we haven't done before, but we build that out in partnership with the client. So that's where we're not just selling kind of like a fixed platform. Like, we do build and respond to what our individual clients want.
I have a question, candid question. So, you know, a lot of folks who try to do in-house solutions, you know, the benefit is it's customized, it's directly what you need. You know, the challenge is it can be expensive to do that. And then the upkeep, you know, stuff can break, stuff can get outdated, your needs evolve. And so sometimes it's like you make a huge upfront investment and you're almost stuck because you don't want to just have write off the sunk cost. You got to keep going and get deeper and deeper and deeper into it. Where is the happy medium of kind of, you're talking about using external data sources, subscriptions, et cetera, now building an in-house solution of what should folks be wary of? What should, maybe I'm misspeaking here a little bit because it's not my world, but I've heard stories of folks say, man, we put in 700 grand and we ended up down a road that didn't add any value. I mean, over to you on that, kind of the ongoing commitment of it, and then the trade-offs of investing that capital in-house on data infrastructure.
Yeah. So I'll speak to how we approach this. So we don't charge like some big amount of money up front. Like, we basically charge a fixed amount month by month. And we also don't require a long-term contract. And what that does is it makes companies more comfortable that if we can't do what we say, they have the ability to cut us loose before they've sunk hundreds of thousands of dollars into the project. We also, our approach is like to prioritize, like, what's the most important thing that we could get done for you right away? And then what's underneath that? We deliver the first thing. It's, you're not waiting forever to get the whole thing. Like, we do incremental releases where you get the first useful thing, and then we're working on the second useful thing. And then often also there is an ongoing maintenance component to it. So we never build something and then hand over the keys and walk away, and then it's up to the company to internally manage that, because they don't have, if they had that skill set, they would just do it in-house to begin with. So when companies work for us, it's generally for the life of their company. Like, we, especially lately with like some, you know, funding stuff running out, like, we're tending to outlive our clients, where like we work with them all the way into the end of the business. And then, you know, that ends up being like, they sell all our assets and they say, you know, we've succeeded. And that ends up being like the end of the relationship. So with us, like, we don't build stuff and walk away, because it really doesn't work. Like, somebody has to own this. Just like if your company had like a jet or something like that, you wouldn't buy the jet and then not have anybody who knows how to maintain the jet. So, you know, we tell people up front, like, if we're going to work together, it'll be us supporting this data system that we're building really forever. Like, so there does need to be that kind of understanding. The way we approach it is usually if we get to the point where, let's say there's 50 things they want us to do, and we, you know, we do all 50 of those things, we can step our monthly rate down some, basically kind of hibernate, where like we keep everything running and, you know, we're there, like we're the security blanket that everything will keep working. We don't have to charge the same rate that we do when we're in development mode. And I like to say, like, if you hire people in-house, you can't have them build you this great data system and then slash their salaries and expect
and pay them less. Yeah.
Yeah. You're like, oh, good job. Now I'm gonna pay you. I'm gonna cut your pay in half. Like, that would go very poorly with an in-house team, but like as an outsource solution, like that's more conducive to how we do business.
Yeah. I mean, I should have framed it like this in the beginning. You're an outsource solution, right? And so the outsource providers is such a good business model for minerals and non-op, because you grow into certain roles and then some you just never need full time in house. And I would argue possibly, you know, this is one of those areas, because you're going to have needs where you're going to ramp it up at times and then scale it back. I mean, same thing happens with title around a large acquisition, or, you know, minerals management up to a certain point, and any kind of niche-y thing to where, yes, you want to hire the best and the top expertise, but you don't necessarily need to pay that kind of talent. You have a W-2 on your payroll.
I'll also add, like, it would be very hard to find like a single person who's good at the different roles that are needed to make all this function. Like, we've got 8 people working at our company right now, but I think like the minimum number of, like, if you boil it down to like, you can't get any smaller than this. We have a data architect who sets up all of our infrastructure is in Azure. That's Microsoft's cloud environment, like kind of like Amazon's AWS. So setting up all the automation processes to grab all the different data sets and orchestrate it so that there's error checking and all that in. That's one role. Then we have my co-founder Justin is that middle piece of, he knows the data sets, he knows the inertias and bolos and like all the nasty back end, how the tables are structured to get the data out, to get it to where it's like sort of analytics ready. That's where like my group comes in of, I know from working with people in the industry for years, like what they're trying to do, how they want to see things. And yeah, that third role of like building out the actual thing, the actual analytics, the dashboard, the Monday morning ops report, whatever it is that, so all three of those roles is really hard to smash into a single person.
100%. Let's just say in a perfect world, you could find 3 suitable candidates that are contractors. You got to go and you got to find all those people, interview them, get them on retainer, all that stuff to have it in kind of one solution.
Like work orchestrate with each other. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, for sure. It becomes really challenging. No, very cool. I guess I want to circle back, finish up the episode here with kind of a different angle. And that's going to be, I mean, you're referring to these as LLM based tools, which I don't know what the hell that means, but I know what ChatGPT is. And
yeah.
Is Google Gemini the Google's equivalent of ChatGPT?
Yeah, that's their AI.
So, I mean, outside of helping folks create content, and outside of, I mean, you've seen this on LinkedIn and whatever, people go, oh, what does ChatGPT think a oil and gas field will look like in 2050? And you see these photos. I mean, it's a fun post. I don't see that having any practical value to a business, but there's clearly far more power to these tools beyond content generation. What do you see as the future, and what are the applications today? You know what minerals and non-op companies are looking to do day to day. How do you think these tools get integrated, and how do you think they continue to get integrated in the upcoming years?
I'm really interested in and actively using these different tools to figure out what are they good at today, and then what does it seem like they're going to get to. So I'll say, you know, if you're in, like, if your listeners are interested, for sure, reach out to me. But what may also happen is like 6 months from now, you may see a demo from like OpenAI that blows your mind. And when that happens, come back and talk to me. Like it might be that this kind of just circles out in the, you know, the ether of things you hear on the news for a while. But I do think this is going to upturn by like the analytics industry, probably all industries, like starts to sound like a little crazy, but like all industries over the next couple of years. I think this is, you know, akin to like the internet or maybe like the steam engine in terms of like this general purpose technology that's going to find thousands of different applications. So to make that more specific, yeah. So GPT-4 is, so OpenAI is like the market leader in terms of building these AI models. They actually just had a demo yesterday of their new model GPT-4o. And I can talk about a little bit about what those new features are. Like, what's the simplest way to think about all this so that you don't have to go down 100 rabbit holes? One, we launched a new site a couple of weeks ago. It's jetrock.ai, which is specifically what we think is going to be happening with AI, with data analytics, like in the business space. But so GPT-4o is like the currently best version. There's other ones, like Google's got a model called Gemini. Anthropic has one called Claude. Those are also good. But I think if you're trying to just follow like the minimum amount, like OpenAI is probably going to continue to be the leader for a while. Where I see it really important for what my group does is, so currently, like we build automated reports, we do interactive dashboards, we talk back and forth with the client to understand their requirements and then explain to them what we've done. And there's that feedback loop. I see eventually, like over months, but a couple of years, these AI assistants being able to do all of that. It can make charts right now. So they can run Python code, like GPT-4 can run Python code in your chat. So when you see people asking, like, how much does a walrus weigh or something like that? And you can also ask, like, if you could load in some data and say, make me a chart of production over time, it'll produce that. And then it does it reliably. So
real quick, because a lot of people get very antsy about proprietary data. And if I put this into ChatGPT, is this open to the public? Is it anonymized? Can I keep it on a private server in the cloud? Like, you know, I've invested millions of dollars in Tidal or this or that. And I don't, if another company gets it, that's detrimental to my company. And they say, you know what, this, all this stuff is too scary. I'm going to get hacked by China. And I'm just going to do it the old school way. What do you say to those people?
There's a couple of different approaches. So if you're just using the free version of ChatGPT, like they'll train their models on your data. That doesn't mean that they're going to like hand out what you've put in, but there's no promises. Like they basically can do whatever they want with your data. So be cautious about that. The paid version of ChatGPT, their security agreement, so they're not allowed to train their models on your data. So if it checks that box, then you have to decide if you're sending them like your data to OpenAI, like, do you trust them? Like you go look at like their SOC 2 compliant and all that. Like you got to go look at their security guarantees and decide, just like when you load your data into Microsoft Azure or AWS, like you got to evaluate their security guarantees. They have invested in making their data secure, but like that's where whoever's in charge of data security has to kind of decide that for themselves. The third version of that is, because OpenAI is partnered with Microsoft, you can run some of this stuff within your own network. Like your data never leaves your little walled garden, which is really interesting for what we do. I'll say the tools that Microsoft has built so far, they lag behind what OpenAI does, like on their paid version. So the landscape that I see right now is there's four or five different proto versions of what I'm talking about, of like an automated analytics engineer who can live respond to requests from clients. There's four or five different solutions and they're all missing at least one kind of like key feature, so that it can't have live data, live access to data, where you have to like upload files manually, or the RAM, like the amount of RAM you can work with is too low, so you can't work with large enough data sets. All those are actually pretty easy things to solve. It's just they need to build out the system a little bit more. It's not like you're inventing new science. To your question of security, there's a couple of different ways to approach it, depending on how much you want to trust OpenAI versus Microsoft. Even this isn't really available yet, but so LLMs are large language models. That's the term for what these new generative AI models are. Getting them small enough so that they can actually live like on your desktop. So then it's actually not even, it doesn't even have to go into the cloud. That is available now, but they're underpowered compared to what like the frontier models can do. So I guess there's several different ways to approach that. But the high level takeaway is there's a lot of powerful things they can do. But I will say right now, like, I'm having a hard time bundling them all up into one package that is easy for like a minerals company to use. Like there's a lot of cool stuff I can do, but I can't at this moment, I can't yet connect all the dots into a super powerful AI chatbot. But I think over the course of months, probably we'll get there. I mean, maybe things take longer and it takes a year or so. But the progression from November 2022 is when all this kind of hit anybody's radar. Going from what we had in end of 2022 to a year and a half later now is lightning speed in terms of like it can write code now and like it can do 100 important things that it couldn't do 18 months ago. And as best as like I'm on like on the internet forums and stuff like that, reading about what's coming next, it doesn't seem like we've hit a limit. So if we see another 18 months like we have in the past, we're going to start to have like really powerful systems that are running the computer. Like it's like integrating into the operating system and you just say, hey, ChatGPT, like generate some new decline curve analysis in Aries, and it'll launch Aries and do all the clicks for you.
And you think if you have all the right data sets there, you could say, hey, ChatGPT, I want to know the average time frame from permit to spud, spud to completion for ConocoPhillips in these counties.
And it can do that now. Like that's a capability today. Like I could do that with my ChatGPT Plus subscription. Like I would need to load the data in. That's like the thing with ChatGPT is that there's not a good way to hook that up into like our back, like our cloud-based data warehouse. There's nothing stopping them from doing that. That's just not a feature that they've been able. But what you just said, like I could easily do that.
Kind of going back to your saying, like there are going to be certain demos that people watch that blow their mind, because right now it's very much kind of in the headlines and people talk about it, but I don't think people really understand the power of it. And I'm one of those. But I'll end the episode with this. I think, you know, I know for sure that understanding how to use prompts effectively is the power of ChatGPT. So there's an expertise needed for that. And, you know, getting the data and tying it all together. And so I think that's where y'all are at. And so I encourage anyone to reach out to Kevin and his team. If you have any kind of fun ideas on, can I do this? And then maybe you can answer those questions and maybe have some fun brainstorms with folks.
Yeah, I'd be happy to talk, kind of explain where I think this is headed and brainstorm use cases. Cause like I said, this is still kind of in the proto period where like it's sort of like it works a lot, but it doesn't necessarily work entirely. And I think about like there's certain periods of time, like when the internet was just coming out, it's like the people who latched onto that at the right, like if you're right place, right time, like they were kind of launched into the stratosphere. And I do see that this, to me, this feels like a similar situation where if we grab these AI tools by the horns, we're going to be really useful to a lot of people as they're trying to figure out how to apply them in their own business.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, very good. Kevin, thanks for coming on. Really interesting. Yeah,
appreciate the chat.
Yeah, it's been great getting to know you, and I look forward to catch up next time in Austin.
Yeah. Yeah, sounds good. We'll hit Sixth Street.
You got it.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to this episode of the podcast. I hope you enjoyed. The Minerals and Royalties podcast is meant for informational purposes only. Tim Powell and the Minerals and Royalties Authority are not promoting any specific securities or investments, nor are they providing any type of investment advice. If you enjoyed the episode, then I encourage you to tune in more and also check out the Minerals and Royalties Authority YouTube channel. Thanks, and see you next time.